You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a ruling on redistricting from the Wisconsin Supreme Court yesterday. In a 4-3 decision, the court approved electoral maps proposed by Governor Tony Evers. We'll find out how that could change the balance of political power in the state and how it compares to the other maps on the table. Now, when somebody says Mexican food, you might think of tacos, burritos, enchiladas, and tamales. While those are a big part of the story, they don't completely represent the full variety of Mexican cuisine. In this week's edition of Food Friday, we're listening back to a talk with Chef Patty Heenich about the full scope of Mexican food. She spent the past decade seeking out the culinary gems of her home country. Some of them are pretty well-known in the U.S. Others are local specialties passed down through generations. Then she figured out how to make those recipes accessible to people outside of Mexico and put the results in her new book. You can find a couple of the recipes we'll be talking about today at WPR.org/Food Friday. And if you have something to share about Mexican food, we'd still love to hear about it. Is there a favorite dish you make at home or that you've tried while traveling? If you've lived in Mexico or your family has roots there, what do you remember about the cuisine? Do you have a recipe to share? Let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us @CentralTimeWPR. Patty Heenich is the host of Patty's Mexican Table on public television. Her new book is Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. Here's a listen to our conversation. Now, this book has been a literal journey. Can you talk about your travels around Mexico and what you were looking for this book?
Absolutely. So, yeah, many, many years in the making. So, I come from Mexico City, and I lived there all my life until I married my husband, moved to Texas, switched careers, you know, after I had my two kids and went from political analysis to cooking. And ever since then, I've just made my life's mission to share everything and anything from Mexico, culture, food, ingredients, stories. And in this book, which is my most ambitious so far, I just went to find, you know, everybody now knows guacamole, and so many things are in the American culinary lingo, like taco and taco Tuesday and taco night, and everybody seems to know birria these days. But in this book, I bring 150 classic recipes that are heirlooms that have been passed on through generations that are treasured, and they may be from a little town or micro region or macro region, but most of these have not crossed the border. And I'm here to tell you, you love Mexican food already? Well, here's more. And this is going to enrich your weekly menus and your table and your family life, and I hope people love it as much as I do.
So Patty, I grew up in a small Midwestern town. I got to say, well into my life, I had a pretty narrow view of what Mexican food was. And it's very slowly dawned on me, Mexico's really big. It has a lot of variety. Can you tell us just how much variety there is within Mexico?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm still in awe, Rob, to be honest. And the more I know and the more I travel and the more I go back, I'm continuously treading, you know, back and forth. And you think you know a place, I think I know a state, I think I know a region, and I go back to try those classics. And I come back and find those classics, and there's many more. There's new dishes, new ways to use ingredients, and people are also really going back and trying to recover or bring to the surface pre-Hispanic dishes and takes. And between the combination of regions, historical eras, and the creativity of Mexican cooks, there never seems to be enough new things to try. So I, you know, here you can find food from all of the country, and each dish has a story tied to it. And I really work so hard to bring these recipes to your kitchen in a way that they're accessible, doable, repurposable, and mostly that they will bring you something that you can try and you're going to say, I want to make this again. And for the people who try them, I'm hoping they're going to say, we want that recipe. And that when you share it, you're also going to be able to share stories.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Patty Heenich about her new book, Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for Patty or you want to share your favorite Mexican meal you've ever had, whether you grew up with it or whether you've encountered it as a tourist somewhere in Mexico. Love to hear from you now at 800 800- 1234. Let's talk about ingredients a little bit, Patty. One thing I loved, I love in your book is you made it so that it's stuff mostly we could find in our local grocery store. And I want to start with tomatoes. I thought, oh, what kind of tomato is Patty going to point me toward? Roma tomatoes, which you could find pretty often, especially good ones in the summer. Why are Roma tomatoes one of your first choices if you're making a salsa?
Well, Roma tomatoes are just so juicy and fleshy and have a wonderful consistency for salsas and stews and soups. They're rich. I mean, I always advise people when you bring tomatoes into your home, if they're not super fully ripe, like bursting, you know, leave them in your kitchen counter and let them continue to ripen. And if you can't find Roma tomatoes, which I think are really the best for like saucy, messy food, which is like what I like, any tomatoes that you find at the store, just let them ripen. I'd rather you use a very ripe tomato that's not a Roma than a green unripe Roma. And if you can't find fresh tomatoes that you're loving, you know, say in the middle of winter, you can use a can of crushed tomatoes. And there's many recipes in my cookbook that call for fire roasted or charred or broiled or roasted tomatoes. And you can now find cans of fire roasted tomatoes. So it's all much more accessible and easy than when I first moved to the US, Rob. I mean, I swear 20 years ago, you were lucky if you found a fresh jalapeno. And I'm talking even in Dallas, Texas. These days, I guess it has to do not only with the demand of, you know, the American audience. People are so much familiar with Mexican food and ingredients that people don't only want to go out and eat tacos, but people want to make Mexican food at home. So that demand has helped, you know, increase the availability. And you can really find almost anything, if not in stores, online.
Let's check out, Patty, one of the recipes you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. This one, I could see it going on a Thanksgiving side dish sort of table here. Green beans in corn sauce with pumpkin seeds. First of all, tell us where this recipe is coming from in Mexico.
Yes, that is one of my favorite recipes in the entire book, Rob. I'm so happy you chose that. And if you see the photo of that recipe, see the stunning green beans, the chunky red tomato sauce on top, and the crushed pepitas, and you would think that a new modern chef came up with this vegan, you know, really regal dish. And this is a recipe that has existed in the Yucatan Peninsula in the state of Campeche for centuries. People have been making it in Mexico since pre-Hispanic times. And this is the beauty about classic recipes, that they stand the test of time. Of course, let me describe this recipe to you. It's green beans that you quickly sear. And after they started to brown, you pour over them a sauce that you make by pureeing fresh corn. If you don't find fresh corn, you can use thawed from frozen. You puree the corn with a little bit of fresh cilantro or epazote if you find it. And then you cook the beans in that corn sauce and they've begun to crisp. And then they start cooking in this sweet corn sauce that becomes velvety and so creamy, and it starts to stick on the green beans. And then you take them out of the pan, and this is really less than 10 minutes. And then you top that with a chunky tomato salsa that you make in a snap. And you garnish that with ground or chopped toasted pumpkin seeds. The combination of flavors is just insane, because you have the green beans, you have that really velvety sweet corn sauce, you have the tart and almost sweet tomato sauce, and then the salty and nutty pumpkin seeds. And it is such a delight. It can be a side. It can be a main. People who are vegetarians or vegans are going to feel like you really spoiled them by giving them something so delicious and not just a boring side of, you know, just bland green beans. And this is a recipe that, of course, it's adapted in my cookbook so that you can make it in your kitchen. But this is a recipe that used to be made by having the ingredients in a pot and throwing in a rock that was heated until it was really just burning hot, and it was thrown in the pot, and that's how the ingredients used to cook. And these were talking about pre-Hispanic times. But this recipe has evolved, and it's been maintained, and it's been passed on through the centuries. And I feel so, you know, so much pride to be able to pass on these recipes so that other people outside of Mexico or Mexicans who aren't from the Yucatan Peninsula can get to know it. And it's, you know, the part of cooking that it's so beautiful because it's communal. You know, these recipes are here before we get here, and these recipes will remain after we leave. So it's just an honor to be able to pass these on.
You can find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Green Bay. Matt, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Patty, I love your show, and I love how it's evolved over the years. My question is, I'm from La Frontera, near in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is like a green chili capital of the United States. And when I learned how to make chile rellenos there, they were crispy and stuffed with cheese, and you would just serve them crispy and eat them with a fork. But since I've moved to Green Bay, we have a lot of people who make chile rellenos from poblanos, and they fry them up, but then they just drown them in tomato sauce. What is it like the chile rellenos? Why is it always drowned down in Central Mexico?
Is that a different regional approach, Patty?
Yeah, and that is such a great question. And in fact, in my new cookbook, Treasures of the Mexican Table, I have a few variations of the chile relleno. And I love that you're asking this question, Matt, because there's a universe of chile rellenos. So the chile rellenos that you're talking about, it's the most popular version. The poblano chiles that are large, chubby, can be super stuffed, and they're typically fire roasted, sweated, and peeled, just like the roasted pimientos, you know, that you use in Italian cooking. So the same thing, the same process is done to poblano chiles. And then the chiles are stuffed either with melted cheese or with picadillo, which is a combination of ground meat cooked in tomato sauce and olives and raisins and almonds, or beans. And then that chile goes drowned in a rich tomato sauce. It can either go directly like that, or most traditionally, that chile that's stuffed goes battered in an egg batter, then fried, which is what you're talking about, and then dressed in that sauce. And I think that is one of the most beloved and the most well-known of Mexican chile rellenos from Central Mexico and Puebla and regions that have a lot of Mexicans that have moved to the U.S. So I guess that's why it's becoming so popular now. But there are many other chile rellenos. I have a chile relleno in the cookbook that is actually a cold chile relleno, and it's a cold and pickled chile relleno. Wow. And it is a delight. And I have been wanting to make this since my first cookbook. And Rox Martin, who I'm so lucky to have had as an editor for all of my cookbooks, kept on telling me on Cookbook 1 and Cookbook 2, I don't think America is ready for this one. And this year, you know, this book, I'm like, we are ready. So imagine a Mexican-style miso salad stuffed in an exuberant fire-roasted poblano chile. This is what this is like. So you take the fire-roasted poblanos, which is, you know, it's a technique that's very simple to do. And then you make a marinade with oil and vinegar, and in that oil you cook onions and garlic and some spices. You marinate the chiles in that until they're slightly pickled, like the pickled jalapenos brine kind of, and you can make this ahead of time and put it in the fridge, and they will wait for you for weeks. And what I do is that when my husband comes home really late from work, which didn't happen throughout the pandemic because we've been locked in, but now that he's starting to go back to the office, and I'm like, no, don't go. But then when he comes back at, you know, very late hours of the day or the night, I just quickly make a tuna salad with, Mexicans love mayo. I don't know if people know, but, you know, tuna, mayo, lime juice, a little bit of celery, a little bit of onion. And you take out those pickled chiles, you stuff that with tuna. And I can't begin to describe the flavor of that.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Patty Heenich about her new cookbook called Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your favorite Mexican food experiences. You can also find recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Patty Heenich from Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. She's got a new book, Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. Still time for your calls or Facebook comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page, your experiences, favorites, questions for Patty at 800-642-1234. Patty, we heard from Paul on Facebook who shared a great experience. Didn't say where, though. Says a quesadilla in a market was amazing. Stretchy cheese, fresh epazote and squash blossoms, and the tortillas made right on the spot. You mentioned that epazote earlier, Patty. Can you talk about that as a spice? You can use that. There's fresh and more available here, I think, dried.
Yeah, absolutely. And the quesadilla that he's sharing, that Paul is sharing, is a typical quesadilla that you find throughout Mexico and increasingly in the U.S., which means you can find it, but not as much as Mexico, but at least you can find it and hopefully more and more. Epazote is a deeply Mexican herb. It is an herb that really defines us. It's very perfumed. It's very intense. It has a very deep, clean taste. It's the best way that I can describe it. You need to use it judiciously because it's that intense. And it's supposed to be a really good digestive, which is why many people cook their beans with epazote. It's absolutely delicious with cheese in a quesadilla because it brings some kind of like fragrant aromatic. It's so hard to describe the taste, Rob, that you really have to try it. You can find the epazote herb increasingly in the U.S. And then if you learn to make your homemade corn tortillas, then you can be making those quesadillas anytime. Now, the blossom, the squash blossoms, which is so common in Mexico, it's much harder to find here. And in Mexico, it's much more accessible and price-wise, much more affordable. But I think we're going to get there.
I've used epazote, and I learned the hard way a little bit. Goes a long way with dried epazote, but I'll take your advice now and try it again.
Yeah, so epazote, yeah, you have to use it judiciously. So I would say if you're using the dried epazote, you need to use like 3 times the amount just because it's like very different in its fresh than its dried form. But it has a very unique taste. I love it.
Well, let's check out some dessert, Patty, because we're getting close to the end of our conversation. You've shared with us a classic creamy flan. That's definitely a dessert I think about when I think about Mexican food. Can you share a little bit of the story behind it?
Ah, yes. And flan, I mean, there's so many different kinds of flan. I was just now at the border, you know, aside from Patty's Mexican Table, this year I launched a new docu-series on primetime with PBS and Amazon Prime. That's all about the borderlands. It's called La Frontera with Patty Heenich. And I went from El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, to Brownsville. And it was incredible. You know, the quality of food is just so phenomenal. And people think that along the Texas-US-Mexico border, you only find Tex-Mex. But you find phenomenal Mexican, you find phenomenal Texan, and you find these regional cuisine, these Tex-Mex cuisine, that's so different in the different parts of the Texas-Mexico border. And you realize that Tex-Mex food is so different at every spot. It's very different in El Paso from the Rio Grande Valley. And I'm connecting it to this, Rob, because there were so many flan. And they were just absolutely extraordinary, from the round individual ones, which is like the creamy one I have in my new cookbook, which is like the flan that you crave for. It's the flan that you find in fondas. It's the flan that you find in, I would guarantee, any Mexican home. It's made with 4 or 5 ingredients, depending if you want to add more flavor or not. Like you can make it like I do here, or you can add some orange rind. But it's just very satisfying. It's satiating. It's after a Mexican meal, especially. It's creamy, it's mild, it's not incredibly sweet, and it's cold, so it's kind of refreshing and soothing.
And Patty, in just our last minute or so, can you leave us some inspiration for people to try cooking and try more variety of cooking inspired by Mexican food?
Yes. I just think that, you know, when you're cooking something new and you're trying something new, it's just a way to open a window to learn so many stories and to enrich your home, not only with a new food or dish, but really stories that can be shared and passed on. So I would recommend that when people hopefully get my cookbook, they find a dish or two that they want to try and begin with, and they'll realize that they're all approachable and easy. And I hope they will read the stories. And as they make the food, they will also share the stories.
Patty, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
That's Patty Heenich, host of the PBS series Patty's Mexican Table. We listened back to a conversation from a few months ago about her newest book. It's called Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. We've posted a couple of recipes from her book over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Try out the ones we heard about there. Her green beans and corn sauce with pumpkin seeds. That sounds pretty good. If you're in the mood for dessert, the classic creamy flan. Both of those sound pretty good right now. If you give them a try, tell us how it goes. And by the way, while you're there, you can check out all of our past conversations on Food Friday. There is a wealth of great food and cooking advice there, and lots of recipes too. Maybe something you can make this weekend. And we're always looking for your ideas on future episodes of Food Friday. If there's a style of cooking or an ingredient or a technique or whatever that you want to learn more about on the air, we would love to hear about it and find somebody to answer your questions. You could let us know. Email centraltime@WPR.org. Again, that email is centraltime@WPR.org. You can always tweet us and follow us on Twitter. We are at centraltimewpr. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, it's the State Capitol Report. At the end of the legislative session, Kate will check in with leaders from both parties in Wisconsin's State Senate, looking at some of the big issues, what passed, what got put on the table maybe for future years, and how they're setting up for an election campaign. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Our news team is looking for some help from you. They're working on a piece on the ways that work and education have changed over the last 2 years during the pandemic, whether that involves remote work and remote learning or other changes. Their question for you, when it comes to education and work, what has changed for the long term? And in what ways has it changed, do you think, for the foreseeable future? Or did things change and then snap back to normal? You can answer those questions online, maybe end up in their upcoming reporting. Go online to WPR.org/Wisconsin. That's like W-H-Y, Wisconsin. There's a link in the feed there where you can share your story about the changing world of work and school. While you're there, you could share a Wisconsin question that we could tackle on future episodes of Central Time. Again, answer that question about the changing world of work and education. Head over to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Helping out our reporters, this is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Ferret. Yesterday, the Wisconsin Supreme Court adopted Governor Tony Evers' plans for new congressional and legislative district maps that will last a decade. Justice Brian Hagedorn joined the court's liberal members in the 4-3 ruling. While the district boundaries from Evers' map will likely maintain a Republican advantage in the legislature, it could narrow the GOP's majority in the Assembly and Senate. We're looking at what Evers' maps mean for Democrats and Republicans in the state and compare them to the other maps that didn't make the cut. John D. Johnson is a research fellow at the Marquette Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. John analyzed all the redistricting plans submitted to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I talked to him earlier today. Let's set up yesterday's decision with a previous state Supreme Court decision that said what they were looking for in a new map, the least changes idea. Not, as I understand, a part of the Constitution on this. What did that decision mean?
That decision meant that if you take a few steps back, Republicans were going to get a very good map for themselves, because it meant that whatever new map was chosen would have to minimize changes from the 2011 gerrymander drawn by Republicans when they had unified control of the state government.
Now we have this decision yesterday. We had a bunch of different maps on offer. The legislature's one from Governor Evers, a revised one with that least change policy in mind, and a few others. They went with Governor Evers' proposal. What does that mean in terms of how big a change there is and what happens with that gerrymander?
Well, I believe they chose Governor Evers' proposal because it moves the fewest people from their old district to a new district. The concept of least change is not clearly defined. Sort of many observers thought it was strange that the justices chose that in their earlier decision that you referenced, but that's the decision they made. And what can least change mean if not moving the fewest residents between districts? And Governor Evers' map is the one that moved the fewest people. So those are the maps that were chosen. So, given that, that means that they're not a whole lot different than what exists in the state right now, but they are better for Democrats than the map that had been proposed by the Wisconsin legislature. To put some specific numbers on that, in a statewide tie, I reckon Democrats right now would likely win 38 seats under the new maps drawn by Governor Evers, which the Supreme Court has just accepted. If they had chosen the legislature's plan, that would be 36 seats for Democrats. To put some perspective on that, Democrats currently have 38 seats. And under the final map drawn by the People's Map Commission, which did not use a least change strategy, Democrats could expect to win 44 seats in a statewide tie. But another way that these are different is how many competitive seats they draw. So we can talk about that, too.
Well, I want to get that the bottom half of that fraction there. That's 38 seats plus or minus out of, I believe, 99 assembly seats. You're saying in a statewide election where the votes come in exactly tied for the assembly, Democrats still come in with a pretty substantial loss when it comes to the number of seats they get.
That's right. Yeah.
Why is that? Even if this is a map endorsed here by Governor Evers, again, with that least change policy in mind.
Yeah, well, the Democrats are at a disadvantage across the state because they are more concentrated in cities. So when you draw districts that are compact and contiguous, which is what our sort of legal standards for drawing districts are, you're going to end up having a handful of extremely blue Democratic seats in places like Madison and Milwaukee, and there won't be similarly extremely red seats just because there aren't really places in Wisconsin that are as deeply Republican as there are places that are very deeply Democratic. Now, that said, that only explains a small part or maybe half of the Republicans' advantage in the state assembly. So that People's Map Commission map, which was drawn by the commission put together by Governor Evers, would have come up with 44 seats for Democrats in a statewide tie. And it was drawn just starting from scratch, looking at the state and drawing compact and contiguous maps. So still a disadvantage to Democrats, but much less of a disadvantage than currently exists. So the plan proposed by Evers that was accepted yesterday by the Supreme Court is worse for Democrats than a sort of randomly drawn map would be, because it was constrained by trying to closely match the map drawn in 2011 by the Republicans who controlled the state government at that point.
Talking to John Johnson from the Marquette Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education, looking at the state Supreme Court's decision on Wisconsin's new voting maps. John, we've talked about the assembly seats, people watching for the congressional seats here in Wisconsin. What do we know about how these maps would affect how those shake out?
Compared to the map proposed by the state legislature, the maps that Evers submitted and that were accepted keep the third district in southwestern Wisconsin pretty competitive. The Republican plan would have tipped it more towards the Republicans, so that will remain a competitive seat. And the new plan also makes the first district in southeastern Wisconsin several points more competitive. So really in Wisconsin, we have a situation now where there are going to be two safe Republican seats, two safe Democratic seats, and two seats which are competitive and probably lean slightly Republican. But in a good year for Democrats, they could hope to win both of those.
Another way to measure, going back to the state legislature now, another way to measure the lean here, we've been talking about, okay, if the votes came out tied, what would the split be? The votes come out tied, Republicans in any of these maps come out ahead. What would it take for Democrats to capture a majority? What would the threshold of statewide vote have to get to put Democrats ahead in, say, the assembly?
So to have a good chance at winning 50 seats in the assembly, which, as you say, would be a bare majority, Democrats would need to win about 53.7% of the vote under the Evers plan. Under the map proposed by the legislature, they would have needed to win 56.2% of the vote. Under the existing maps, they would need to win about 54.3% of the vote. So you can see this is a modest improvement for Democrats from the existing map, and it's considerably better than the map that the Republicans themselves proposed during this cycle. It is not as good for Democrats as the map that was submitted by the People's Map Commission, which ignored the least change criteria. Under that plan, Democrats could have hoped to win a majority of the assembly with just a 51.3% statewide victory.
Anything else strike you as interesting or noteworthy about the maps as they stand now after this approval by the state Supreme Court?
One thing I've been sort of amused by is the fate of Stevens Point, which I'm sure it's been frustrating for the people in Stevens Point to feel like a political football being kicked around through both this redistricting cycle and the previous one. But as some of your listeners will know, Stevens Point is part of this odd panhandle coming off of the 3rd Congressional District. It's contiguous, but it's definitely not compact. And it was drawn that way in 2011 because the Republican mapmakers wanted to put that Democratic stronghold of Stevens Point into the 3rd Congressional District, which at that time they saw as a safe Democratic seat that they weren't going to try to pick off. Now, as voting patterns have changed, the third seems like a good pickup opportunity for Republicans. And so they wanted to hasten that process along by making the third district more compact and removing Stevens Point from it. So that was the plan that they submitted to the Supreme Court. And now they submitted their plan before the Supreme Court ruled that they wanted least change to be the criteria. Evers saw that ruling and submitted his own least change map, in which he perfectly preserved the old strange panhandle of Stevens Point in the third district, which was drawn to benefit Republicans in 2011, but now in 2022 actually benefits Democrats. So there are ways in which the least change plan, although generally favorable to Republicans, in some instances did actually help Democrats.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
John D. Johnson is a research fellow at the Marquette Law School's Lubar Center for Public Policy Research and Civic Education. In January, he published an analysis of all the redistricting plans that were submitted to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. He joined us for a look at what the new district maps would mean for Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin. For more on this process, follow the news at WPR.org and check out the recent WPR Reports podcast, Mapped Out. Coming up, the January 6th Congressional Committee says President Trump and his associates may have committed criminal acts in their efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. A legal expert joins the show for a look at the accusations and what they mean. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. This week, we got one of the biggest updates we've seen in the ongoing work of the House of Representatives Select Committee that's investigating the insurrection of the nation's capital on January 6th, 2021, and the events leading up to it. In a court filing, the committee's legal team claimed they've gathered evidence that Trump and others he was working with to overturn the 2020 election may have broken several laws. That comes from numerous depositions from top aides to former President Trump and former Vice President Mike Pence. David Schultz is a distinguished university professor of political science and legal studies. He teaches political science at Hamline University and is a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me again.
There's a lot going into this, David. Can you give us the basics? What does this suggestion of possible criminal activity, where did this come from?
Okay, so this is the January 6th commission that's doing our January 6th committee, which is reviewing the events of that day. They've gathered an incredible amount of information, as you indicated in your introduction here. And in a filing that was released a couple of days ago, which is about 100 pages long, they detail all the factual allegations regarding how Trump worked with his staff, and staff tried to convince him that first there was no election fraud, but he nonetheless persisted in what he was doing. And it talks about how he and several of people associated with him, including John Eastman, as a private attorney, basically conspired to try to overthrow the 2020 election. And so what we found in the document that was released the other day was an effort to try to get what's called a breaking of the attorney-client confidentiality between Trump and his attorney, John Eastman. And in there, what was indicated are three possible criminal charges that could be brought against Donald Trump, as well as some of his associates. And if I can briefly mention them here, one is that the argument is that the president and maybe others obstructed or tried to obstruct an official government proceeding of the United States. That is the counting of the electoral votes. Second, there's an argument that in fact, the president and his campaign engaged in a criminal conspiracy to defraud the United States by trying to trick people or fool people into thinking there was widespread voter fraud. And then the last is that there may have been under state law in the District of Columbia, there might have been a violation of what's called common law fraud, deception. But put this together, what they're saying at this point is that because we believe we have enough evidence at this point to believe that the president and his associates may have been breaking the law, that is a basis for us to want to now what? Force John Eastman, his attorney, to divulge private communications between him and Donald Trump for the purposes of us investigating criminal activity. This is pretty significant.
This is an effort, as you said, to get access to these emails, overcome the attorney-client privilege claim here. This is a congressional committee, though, not a prosecutorial agency or body. What would it take to get from there, these claims from a congressional committee, to somebody actually filing charges under those claims?
Well, what could happen at this point is once they complete their report, they could then refer this over to the Justice Department, and the Justice Department could, based upon this report, opt to indict on, let's say, at least the federal charges. Obviously, it has limited authority over what the District of Columbia does. But that would be the process at this point in terms of preparing a report that would then be used as the basis, perhaps, for the Justice Department to indict the president or any of his ex-president or any of his associates.
We don't have a lot of precedent for ex-presidents being charged with crimes, right? It's a pretty tall order.
It is a very tall order at this point. And the closest we've ever gotten is Richard Nixon. And of course, this was all about what? Crimes that Nixon allegedly committed while he was president of the United States. Back in the 70s, the argument was that a sitting president could not be indicted, which is why for some people who might have remembered the phrase Nixon and as an unindicted co-conspirator, it wasn't clear that a sitting president could be indicted. But there's nobody that I know of, any respectable legal authority that would say that an ex-president cannot be indicted for crimes, even for crimes committed while he was president of the United States. So if this were to happen, this would be an unprecedented move in American legal history.
Right. We didn't get that question addressed, right? Because President Ford, who succeeded former President Nixon, pardoned him. And that prevented these questions from going into the courts. Do you think they might have without that pardon?
I think at that point, had Nixon no longer been president and had it moved forward in terms of an investigation and indictment, it's more than likely that he probably would have been indicted. And you're absolutely correct that Gerald Ford decided to issue a presidential pardon to prevent that from going forward. Again, if you look at Justice Department documents from back in the 1970s, there seemed to be a consensus that yes, an ex-president, a person who's no longer a president or not president, could be indicted. The whole focus then was on a sitting president. And that's why Ford pardoned him, because Nixon at that point no longer enjoyed any type of presumption of perhaps not being able to be indicted.
Talking to David Schultz from Hamline University and University of Minnesota, looking at the January 6th commission, some news out there in a court filing saying potential to believe that criminal activity committed by President Trump and some of his closest advisors in their efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election results. David, in this, as you say, 100-page filing, there were some emails, I think new ones that we hadn't seen before, related to John Eastman on January 6th, back and forths with the staff of Vice President Pence. Eastman trying to persuade the staff, to persuade Pence to put off the counting of electoral votes, even saying at one point, acknowledging this would be at least a minor violation of relevant law. Did you see anything shocking in this?
I did see that. I mean, first off, and I think that this report or this memorandum made it clear, is that there is no basis in the law whatsoever for arguing that the Vice President of the United States or that Congress really has the authority to set aside electoral votes. The Constitution and the 12th Amendment are very clear on this. And part of what the court is arguing here is to say that there was no good faith argument that Eastman could make to the president to say, you know, we think you have some authority to order Pence or get Pence to do this. And so Eastman is basically telling Pence to do something that clearly, and I would say clearly, any lawyer worth his or her salt would know that this was not possible under the Constitution. But yet, needless to say, he pushes on. And but I think the purpose of this request for privileged information is to find out what else Eastman did. What else was he advising the president? And so this is what makes it so significant here, is that we effectively have somebody who's providing advice to the president, if everything in here is true and accurate, that was basically telling the president, guess what, violate federal law and urge your vice president to violate federal law and the U.S. Constitution.
There's been a lot of attention to testimony to the committee that suggests that people were telling, as you mentioned, telling then President Trump that there hadn't been significant fraud. Also out in a new book, former Attorney General William Barr says basically the last thing he did as Attorney General was telling President Trump, no, there wasn't significant widespread fraud. You lost the election. Why is it important for people to make that case? Is that related to that potential fraud?
Well, I think what's important at this point is that, first, if people have broken the law, they should be held accountable. But two, and I think without being too dramatic here, this is about American democracy, that even if at the end of the day, Trump or his associates aren't indicted, it's a statement about saying that there are certain things you can't do in a democracy, in a country like the United States, and that includes what? Basically trying to overturn democratically elected elections. And you can't go around lying about the fact that there's voter fraud and then use those lies as a basis for trying to challenge election results. I think that's the broader point that comes out of this, is that sometimes principle matters. And I think this is partly what's going on here.
I won't ask you to predict the future, David. How likely do you think it is, though, that somebody, say an attorney general or someone within the Justice Department, would pick up this information from the congressional committee and run with it and indict the president's advisors, maybe the former president himself?
I think the pressure is going to be tremendous on at least going after the president's advisors. The question becomes, to what extent going after Donald Trump, is that something that the Justice Department wants to take on in terms of it being potentially an incredibly divisive issue? And maybe that's why Gerald Ford back 50 years ago pardoned Richard Nixon, to say Nixon probably did something wrong, but we'd be better off what? Basically saying he did something wrong, pardon him, and let history be the judge. And that could very well be what would happen too.
And David, in our last minute or so, apart from these possible indictments, do you see any other safeguards, things that need to be changed to prevent a current or future president from losing an election, but going to this long effort to overturn that outcome?
Well, first off, they're talking about revising the Electoral Count Act in terms of what Congress's role is. I think part of that is necessary in terms of just simply making clear what the law can do. But remember, presidential elections and Senate and U.S. House elections are done on a state-by-state basis. And I think what needs to be done is to insulate the election process, the election administration, even more from political influence. And what's dangerously going on right now is just the opposite, politicizing it. We probably need to insulate it more so that this doesn't happen in the future.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you to the audience.
That's David Schultz, Distinguished University Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies at Hamline University, Professor of Law at the University of Minnesota. He joined us today for a look at a new court filing from the House Committee investigating the January 6th insurrection that lays out evidence for a possible criminal case against former President Donald Trump and some of his associates. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we'll get the latest on the Russian invasion of Ukraine, including the latest developments over the weekend, plus a look at the international response to the invasion. And rental costs are up around the country. Wisconsin is no exception. We'll find out what's driving the high cost of rental housing, what it means for low and middle income renters. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.